would be pulsed out through the base's rumor network and become fodder for every idle conversation until something truly worthy of discussion displaced it. Adding some forward thrust, he moved the X-Wing into the magnetic atmospheric containment bubble and threw it to the airless exterior. Once outside, he kicked the Incom 4L4 fusel thrust engines in at full power and rocketed away from the craggy gray lunar surface. He rolled the X-Wing and brought the nose up slightly, sending the fighter into a gentle arc toward the horizon. The data screen in front of him reported the engines were working at 105% of efficiency, an increase he put down to Verpine tinkering. Throttling back to 70%, then 65%, he dropped his speed and flipped a switch above his right shoulder. The stabilizer foils split and locked into the cross pattern that had given the X-Wing its name. He glanced at the upper left corner of the screen and saw his R5 unit had been designated Minock. Are you called Minock because you draw a lot of power? Urgent whistles and tweets were translated to a scrolling line of text at the very top of the screen. A pilot once said I screamed like a Minock when we were in combat. A slander, Commander. I can understand that. No one likes to be thought of as a space rat. Wedge shook his head. I need you to adjust the acceleration compensator down a bit. I want 0.05 gravity. The astromech droid complied, and Wedge immediately began to feel more at home in the cockpit. To combat the effects of negative and positive gravity because of maneuvers, the starfighter had a compensator that created a gravity-neutral pocket for both the craft and pilot. It prevented a lot of problems with blood flow and black or red outs in pilots, but Wedge felt it insulated him from the machine and left him out of touch with his situation. Flying with all gravity negated felt to him like trying to pick up grains of salt while wearing heavy gloves. It might be possible, but it would be a lot easier without the interference. Flying required use of all the senses, and the compensator cut out most kinesthetic sensations. And that kills pilots. Wedge was convinced that some pilots had died unnecessarily because they couldn't feel where they were. Jek Porkins, a heavyset man who always had his compensator on at full, had plowed into the first Death Star while trying to pull out of a dive. His repeated assurances of, "I can hold it! I can hold it!" died in a burst of static as his X-Wing slammed into the Emperor's toy. Had Porkins not been compensated, he could have realized he wasn't pulling up, and he might have had time to do something else. Flying without full compensation is just one more thing we need to teach these kids. Wedge laughed at himself. Aside from Gavin, the whole crew in Rogue Squadron was almost his own age, or older. He thought of them as kids because they hadn't seen the sort of duty he and Tycho had. And with what we'll teach them, maybe they'll survive longer than the rest did. Wedge rolled the X-Wing again as he hit the Terminator line, and daylight flopped into darkness. Punching a console button, he changed his screen over to a tactical scanner and picked up a dozen other traces. The screen reported and tagged 11 X-Wings and one Z-95 XT trainer, the benign version of the X-Wing's little brother. He switched his comm over to the tactical frequency he shared with Tycho. Everyone green and running, Tycho?
Affirmative. Systems are go. There's been some grumbling about feeding at the pig trough, however.
No surprise there. Shifting to TAC-1.
I copy.
Flipping the comm over to the frequency shared by the rest of the squadron, Wedge caught the last of a comment by Rogue 9, Corin Horn.
Blind wallowing pigs! And slow!
I'm sure, Rogue 9, your comrades who fly Y-Wings will be pleased to know what you think of their ships.
Sorry, sir.
Good.
The unit commander throttled back and fed his repulsor lift generators enough power to counter the moon's gravity. The reference to Y-wings, their slow speed and the underpowered nature of their sensors, had been heard in Rebel camps since the earliest days of fight against the Empire. The B-wings had been developed to counter the flaws with the Y-wing and replace it in service, but production had yet to meet demand, so plenty of Y-wings still saw service. Their reputation as wallowing pigs had led to the naming of the Folor gunnery and bombing range, the Pig Trough. Alliance Command had originally designated it the Trench, as a memorial to the pilots who had died running the artificial canyon on the Death Star. But pilots saw no reason to stand on ceremony. Y-wings practiced their bombing runs in the twists and turns of the Lunar Canyon, while fighter pilots preferred the rolling and looping demanded of them in the satellite field circling the moon.
"Today I want you all to do some basic work on the gunnery range. Laser targets have been set up to provide you a number of flying and targeting challenges. Your run will be graded for accuracy and speed, and if you get hit, you'll lose points. If you suffer an equipment failure, pull out and you'll get another run after things are fixed. We don't want to lose you or the equipment, so try not to do anything stupid. Any questions?"
Horn's voice squawked through the helmet headset.
"Sir, our lasers are zeroed at 250 meters, which is a little short for ground attack missions."
"I guess then you'll have to be very good and very quick in shooting, won't you, Mr. Horn?"
"Yes, sir."
Wedge smiled. "Good. Then perhaps you'd like to go first. Mr. Quirk will fly your wing."
"Yes, sir."
The enthusiasm in Horn's voice matched the energy in the roll and die his X-Wing executed.
"Shifting to ground attack mode."
"Good luck, Mr. Horn."
Wedge killed his comm unit.
"Minok, pull a sensor feed from Horn's R2. Shoot it to Captain Selchu on TAC 3.
He popped his comm over to TAC 2.
"Captain, you'll be getting a data feed from Rogue 9.
"It will be interesting to watch. He's going in hot."
"That he is, Tycho. Very hot. He wants to set a mark the others can't possibly hit." Wedge nodded slowly. "I think he needs to get a different lesson today. Here's what we'll do."
8. Corrin pulled out his dive and skimmed the surface of Folor. He aimed the nose of his snub fighter at the paired mountains that marked the opening of the Pig Trough. A line of red lights burned on and off in sequence, seeming to send the light from the plains to the peaks of the gray mountains. Below him, the rough rims of countless craters flashed past.
"9. Should 10 shift shields forward?"
"Negative 10. Even them out. We'll probably have targets at our backs."
Corrin glanced at his data screen.
"Whistler, can you boost my forward sensors? Screen for background formations and pick out what's anomalous." Yes, take care of your communications link first, but just do it. Thanks."
After a couple of seconds, the astromech droid complied with the request, and the image on the data screen refined itself. The mountains appeared in a light shade of green, and likely targets, in this case the lights on the mountains, were translated into red circles that began to blink when he had a clear shot at them. From past experience, he knew Whistler would turn the circles into diamonds if they proved to be hostile. The fighter shot forward into the trench. Tall, jagged walls rose tall on either side of him. Unlike canyons carved through stone by the relentless flow of water, this one boasted sharp walls that would grind a fighter into dust.
"It seems as if I'm flying between teeth, not stones."
He guided the fighter up over a small rise and then down into a valley where two red circles became diamonds. His cannons tracked left and lit up the first target, while laser fire from the Gand hit the second.
"Nice shooting, Ten."
"Moro was anxious. Moro will wait for clearance to fire in future."
"Not at all. Two more targets. I've got them."
Corrin let his fighter drift to the right.
Pick up what I drop.
That's ordered.
Corrin pulled back on his stick and climbed sharply to get at the first target. He shot it before its laser could depress enough to shoot back at him. Rolling his ship to the left, he moved back to the center of the canyon, then finished the roll with an inside loop that brought him down to target the second diamond. It hit him once before he took it out, but the shot from the target did not penetrate his shields. Climbing back up, Corrin stood the fighter on its right S-foil and arced around a corner in the trench. Coming up to let his sensors read the valley beyond a steep rise, he took laser fire from two bunkers nearly a kilometer distant. He pushed the stick forward and brought the X-Wing down to the deck, then worked his way back up to the rise. I've got the one on the port side. You take starboard. A brief, high-pitched whistle came through the comm to signal Oral's understanding of the order. The X-Wing streaked over the ridgeline and immediately started taking fire from the target on the left. Corrin dipped below it, intending to repeat his steep climb run from before when Whistler started wailing. A threat light burned in the aft position. Full shields aft, Whistler! Laser bolts shot past the X-Wing as Corrin jinked to the left. He punched the right rudder pedal, vectoring thrust to kick the tail of his fighter into a bit of a skid to port. Doing that took him out of line with both guns, while allowing him to keep his nose on his intended target. He triggered four bursts of fire, hitting with the second and third. He rolled the fighter to present its belly to the mountain wall that had housed the gun he'd silenced. Then he cut in his repulsor lift generators. They created a field that bounced him off the wall and pushed him back toward the center of the canyon. Rolling back down to starboard, he killed the repulsor lift generators and dove to pick up a little speed. In doing so, he came out beneath Oral and still had laser bolts popping past him. Whistler shifted views of the canyon for a moment and showed Corrin what had been happening in that section. An emplacement had been located on the reverse slope of the rise. Had Corrin not ducked his ship back down when he took fire the first time, his sensors might have picked up its location. I would have come up, looped, hit it, then rolled out and picked up the right side target. Oral could have nailed the left target, and we'd have been set. Forward view again, Whistler. Seeing the array of targets upcoming, Corrin trimmed his speed back to allow him more time on target. It's going to get busy. Whistler hooted something about understatement. Targets came fast and seemed to get more accurate the deeper he ran into the trench. Corrin tapped his lucky charm once, then forced himself to concentrate. He analyzed target locations and plotted angles of attack. Rolling his fighter, diving and climbing, he wove his way through the gunnery course. He didn't get every target he shot at, but fewer of them hit him. Two-thirds of the way through the course, Corrin and Oral had approached another ridge, like the one that had hidden a gun position on its back slope. Drop back, Ten. Let me draw fire from any backslope guns. Then you can roll in and nail them. A squeal answered him. Corrin sailed up over the rim prematurely and snapped a shot off at the guns to the left. Rolling wide to the right, he sideslipped out of fire from below. Mid-slope down, Ten. Without waiting for confirmation, Corrin corkscrewed his X-Wing around and lased the starboard target. The port target still fired at him, but he dove below its line of bolts and cruised farther into the canyon.
Oral got it, man.
Congrats, Ten. Coming around the last sweeping turn, Corrin saw a narrowing of the canyon down toward the deeper part of it. Above that crevasse, four laser targets had a perfect field of fire for blowing any X-Wing out of the sky. But they couldn't shoot down into the split in the rocks. Whistler, give me the width of that crevasse. The droid mournfully reported it was 15 meters on average, 12.3 meters wide at the most narrow point. Good. The walls will cover me. Behind him, anticipating him, Oral had already rolled his X-Wing up on its starboard S-foil. Corrin smiled and dipped toward the crevasse while keeping his wings parallel to the ground.
Nine, you need to roll.
Negative 10. It's wide enough. A meter to spare on each side.
If you go dead down the middle...
If I don't, I'll be dead. Taking a deep breath, Corrin focused on an imaginary point about 10 meters off the nose of his fighter. He kept his hand gentle on the stick and steered for that point. He kept it in the middle of the crevasse, floating left and right as sections of the wall jutted out from one side or the other. The choke point closed with him. Easy, easy. He drifted to port for a half meter, and suddenly the tight spot was behind him, without his having left any paint on either side of it. The wall streaked by, black and gray blurred together. Corrin found himself steering the ship almost effortlessly. He knew he could have handled the run at full throttle and not had a problem. It almost feels as if I have kilometers off each S-foil, not a meter or two. The bright line marking the end of the crevasse yawed open before him. And now I've got targets. Swooping up and out of the rock slit, Corrin's X-Wing spat fire. He started with the lowest target, hit it squarely with the first shot, then tracked his fire up and to the starboard with a roll and climb. He blasted the second target, then continued his roll until he was inverted. Firing two controlled bursts got him the third gunnery station, and Oral, threading Corrin's loop, targeted the last one. Corrin came down, around, and shot past Oral as they headed out of the range. Hauling back on the stick, he stood his X-Wing on its tail and rocketed away from Fulmer. Rolling out into a long loop, he traded distance for time and pulled up on Oral's wing as they both headed in toward where the rest of the squadron orbited. Commander Antilles' voice filled Corrin's helmet.
Very impressive flying, Mr. Horn. Your score is 3250 out of a possible 5,000. Quite good.
Corrin smiled broadly. Hear that, Whistler? Rogue Leader was impressed. He activated his comm unit. Thank you, sir.
You can head back to base now, Mr. Horn. Your participation in this exercise is at an end. Consider yourself at liberty for the rest of the day.
Yes, sir. Rogue 9 heading home. Yeah, I was at liberty. Liberty to be humiliated. Muscles bunched at the corners of Corrin's jaw as he ground his teeth. He'd waited in the hangar for the others to come back to base, hoping to hear his mark had stood through the rest of the exercise. He knew he was looking for congratulations on his great flying, but not in the egotistical way Bror Jace would have been. He didn't want to lord it over the others, but he did want to know they thought he was good. The others had come back in pairs, and for the most part had tried to avoid him. Lujane Forge and Andorni Hui had been the first to return. As he saw their ships come in, his smile became broad. He knew he had blown past any score they could set.
They're good pilots, but I was really flying out there. They couldn't touch me today.
And Dorney had remained silent, possibly brooding. But who could tell with Rhodians? Lujane had been almost apologetic.
I got 3,300, Corrin. And Dorney hit 3,750.
What?
Lujane hesitated, tucking a strand of brown hair behind her left ear.
It was just our day to fly, Will. You inspired us, really.
Inspiring, Horn.
The Rhodian's ears rotated toward him, then back again, as Andorni wandered away. Lujane gave him a sympathetic smile.
Want to head to downtime and get something to eat?
The tone of her voice suggested strongly that he wanted to take her up on her offer, to spare himself from what was headed in his direction. Despite the unspoken warning, he'd shaken his head.
Thanks. Maybe I'll see you at the TAPCAF later.
Corrin continued to wait for the rest of the squadron to return. Peshk Vrsik and Oral came back together.
The ruddy-furred Boffin took great delight in reporting a score of 4,200. The Gand had been very quiet, and when he finally spoke, he said,
"Quag scored 40-50.
That answer told Corin something very strange was going on. In reverting to calling himself by his family name, Oral had shown himself to be ashamed of his score. But Corin knew he should have been ecstatic about it instead. The fact that Oral clearly didn't want to speak with Corin, and only relented after Corin insisted, meant that whatever Oral was ashamed of had to do with Corin. The others in the squadron didn't say much of anything except to report their scores. Each pilot had scored better than Corin, and most had done so by over 1,000 points. That didn't seem possible to Corin. He knew he had flown that course as best he could. On subsequent runs, I might score up in that range, but not first time out. That's not possible. Unless...
Corin jogged over to where Whistler had plugged himself into a recharging outlet.
Whistler, at the start of our run, you set up a communications link with someone. Who?
The droid's holographic projector began to glow.
A miniature image of Wedge Antilles floated between them.
You sent him my sensor data, right?
Sharp, scolding whistles followed an affirmative tone.
I know I didn't prohibit it!
A curt squawk made Corin wince.
Yes, Whistler, I did approve your action. Never again give out that sort of data without my permission. Got it?
The little droid piped demurely, then shifted to the sing-song tone he'd used to warn Corin when Lore had entered the Corsec office. The pilot turned and saw the headhunter trainer come through the MagCon bubble, followed closely by Rogue Leader. Purposely ignoring Whistler's bleats, Corin watched the ship land.
Time to get some questions answered.
Corin felt a tug at his flight suit leg as Whistler's pincer attachment closed on the cloth. He pulled away, tearing the material.
You betrayed me once here, Whistler. Don't compound the problem.
The droid's mournful tones played out in time with a funeral march as Corin closed with Wedge's X-Wing.
He ducked beneath the nose and snapped to attention as Wedge descended the ladder. His throat thick with anger, Corin saluted and held his quivering hand in place until Wedge returned the salute.
Do you want to speak to me about something, Mr. Horn?
Yes, sir!
Wedge tugged off his gloves.
Well? Permission to speak frankly, sir?
Knock yourself out, Mr. Horn.
Corin's hands convulsed into fists.
You gave everyone else my targeting data. I flew my heart out and flew that course as good as anyone possibly could on his first time through. You turned that data over to the others, so they were making a run based on the things I had done. You gave them my score as a base, and they built on it.
Wedge's brown-eyed glaze did not waver as he met Corin's stare. And?
And... it's not fair, sir. I'm one of the best pilots in this squadron, but it looks like I'm the worst. The others appear better, but they're not. I've been robbed.
I see. Are you finished?
No.
Well, you should be. Or you can be. Do you understand me?
The icy tone in Wedge's voice filled Corin's guts with frozen needles.
Yes, sir.
Wedge nodded past him toward the exterior of the base.
You need to examine why you're here, Mr. Horn. You're part of a team, and you have to act like it. If I need you to shoot a trench like that and feed your data back to a Y-Wing squadron coming through, I'll have you do it. How good you are means nothing if the rest of the people in the squadron get killed. You might be the best pilot in the squadron, but the squadron is only as good as the worst pilot in it. Today the others learned to use data from a reconnaissance flight to help them through deadly territory. You learned that you're not more important than anyone else in the squadron just because you're a gifted pilot. I'm pleased with those lessons having been learned by my people. If you're not, I'm certain there are other squadrons who would love to have Rogue's washouts.
Corrin's cheeks burned, and his stomach turned itself inside out.
He's right. He saw the same thing Lu Jane did, and found a way to point out how serious a problem it can be. I've been an idiot.
He swallowed hard.
Yes, sir.
Yes, what, Mr. Horn?
I'm happy learning what I learned, sir. I want to stay with the squadron.
Wedge nodded slowly.
Good. I don't want to lose you. You've got the makings of a superior pilot, but you aren't there yet. You have the skills you need, but there's more to being part of the squadron than flying well. The training you get will be a bit different from the others, but your need to learn is just as great. Do you understand?
Corrin nodded.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
Wedge handed his helmet and gloves to an astromech.
And just so you know, you're right to be angry. Remember this, though. Giving in to that kind of anger in battle will get you killed. I don't think you want that any more than I do.
The leader of the squadron tossed him a sharp salute.
You're dismissed, Mr. Horn.
Corrin returned the salute, spun on his heel, and marched stiffly away, deeper into the hangar. He threaded his way through the fighters, stepping over power cables and around tool carts. He purposely steered himself away from where Whistler was recharging. The little R2 unit had perfected an I-told-you-so whistle that Corrin realized he'd heard far too often since his father's death.
Mr. Horn!
Corrin stopped and blinked away the gathering clouds of dark memories. His hand rose in a salute.
Captain Selchew!
The blue-eyed man returned the salute, then crossed his arms over his chest.
Still walking and talking?
Sir?
Either Commander Antilles is losing his touch in dressing down recruits, or...
Tycho smiled lopsidedly. You're made of sterner stuff than I might have otherwise imagined.
9. Corrin's green eyes narrowed. I don't think the commander cut me any slack, sir.
Tycho held a hand up.
Forgive me, Mr. Horn. That did not come out the way I wanted. From your Corsec record, and the way you tend to excel in scenarios where you act alone, you've struck me as a loner. Loners don't tend to like it when they're made to be a team player.
But that's not how I am, is it?
Corrin frowned.
I can work with others, but I know I can only rely on myself when things fall apart. I can't help that attitude, because it kept me alive in tough times.
Tycho pointed toward the passage deeper into Folor base, and Corrin fell into step with him.
The problem with that attitude, Corrin, is that it keeps others away. It makes it more difficult for them to help you when you need it. It keeps them uncertain that you will help them when the time comes that they need you.
Hey, I'll never leave a buddy in trouble.
I don't doubt that. But you define buddies on your terms. Others may not see themselves as your friends.
The taller man pressed his lips together in a grim line.
It's clear that being here is not easy for you.
That's an unwarranted assumption. I've adjusted as well as anyone.
Corrin glanced to the right at Tycho.
Why do you think that, sir?
You were with the Corellian Security Force and spent a good deal of your time hunting down people who are now your allies. That transition isn't something you can make overnight.
It couldn't have been any easier for you, sir. You were an Imperial pilot.
Tycho did not reply immediately, and Corrin sensed a window of vulnerability that had opened, then slammed shut almost immediately. He knew it with the certainty he'd known when he'd hit on lies suspects told him during interrogation. He wanted to pounce and push, but the hint of pain he saw flash through Tycho's eyes stopped him.
Let's just say, Corrin, that my situation was quite different from yours.
Tycho's face slackened into an emotionless mask.
Different time, different circumstances.
Corin heard pure honesty in Tycho's words and decided against pushing. That honesty cleared his mind and punched through walls he didn't realize he'd erected.
You might be right, sir. Looking around here, I see the sort of smuggler's hideaway my father and I ached to bust wide open. Just looking at this place, I know it had to have been used by smugglers before the Alliance turned it into a base. If I'd known then what I know now...
You would have been even more convinced that the rebellion was wrong.
Yeah. I guess I would have.
Corin slapped his own belly with his right hand.
I remember being in the Corsec Academy when the Imperial warrants for Han Solo and Chewbacca were issued. They were charged with the murder of Grand Moff Tarkin. No word about the Death Star, of course. I remember thinking that if I were already in Corsec, I'd have gotten Solo. I thought he was a blot on Corellia's honor.
The hint of a smile tugged at the corners of Tycho's mouth. And you still do. Corin winced.
He smuggled spice for a hut. I understand that he made some choices that made his life fall apart. I can sympathize with his freeing Wookiee slaves. No one on Corellia liked the idea of slaves. But he sank pretty low after that.
Tycho nodded. When your life disintegrated, you didn't sink that far. So he shouldn't have?
Something like that.
Corin stopped just before they entered the corridor out of the hangar.
Is that your assessment of my opinion? Or your assessment of Solo in relationship to your leaving Imperial service as he did?
Tycho's smile broadened.
Interesting insight. I think there was a time that Solo, who had bound his conception of honor to his service to the Empire, forgot that honor could exist outside Imperial service. This seems to be a misconception that has been corrected.
And correcting it won him fame, glory, and Princess Organa.
True, but what's important is that he knows honor exists inside you and can only radiate out. What goes on outside can't change it or kill it unless you abandon your honor. Too many folks give it up too easily, then do whatever they can to fill the void in their hearts.
Tycho shook his head.
Forgive me this little lecture. I've had an unfortunate amount of time to think about this sort of stuff.
Two Alliance security officers walked over to where Corin and Tycho stood. The female lieutenant spoke with a calm, even voice.
Captain Selchu, are you ready to return to your quarters now?
The taller man suddenly looked very fatigued, as if his skeleton had just become one size smaller, so his flesh hung loosely from it.
Yes, I believe so. Thank you for this conversation, Mr. Horn.
You're welcome, sir.
Tycho nodded to the woman.
After you.
No, sir, she said. After you.
Her tone struck Corin as all wrong. He had assumed she had been offering to escort Captain Selchu to his quarters as a courtesy, but the edge in her voice transformed her words into an order.
Why would they be forcing him to return to his quarters? I don't understand. She's treating him like a criminal.
He stared after them, trying to reconcile the security officer's action with a need to protect Tycho from some threat. He couldn't imagine anyone in the Alliance base who would begrudge Tycho's actions taken before he joined the rebel cause. Becoming a rebel was like starting over. The data screen was wiped and the past forgotten.
Yet I still have reservations about Han Solo. Even so, I don't want to murder him, so he doesn't need protection.
He realized he was attempting to rationalize why Tycho was being escorted by armed guards. And the most simple answer was, because Tycho presented a threat to the Alliance in some way. The obvious ludicrousness of that idea shone like a supernova, because if Tycho was a threat of any sort, no one would trust him to be teaching pilots how to fly.
Then again, he is assigned a headhunter trainer.
There you are.
Corin's head came up at the sound of the woman's voice. just a bit taller than he was, but slender and walking on very shapely long legs. She entered the hangar from the corridor and stared right at him. Corin turned and looked behind himself to see whom she was addressing, but when he looked back at her, she had stopped right in front of him.
I was wondering where you were.
Me? Corin raised an eyebrow.
Are you sure you were looking for me, Irisi?
She nodded confidently. Sympathy played through her big blue eyes.
I was sent to find you. The rest of us are in downtime, going over what's happened out there.
Not enough laughs? So you wanted me to join you?
He shook his head.
Thanks anyway. Some other time.
No. Now.
Irisi took firm hold of his left elbow.
We do want you there, so we can apologize.
Corin hesitated, covering his surprise. She sounded sincere, but she was from Thyfera, and almost always in Bror Jace's company. He tried to figure out if she was setting him up, but the gentle way her short black hair lay against the nape of her long neck distracted him.
I'm not sure I'd be good company.
You must come.
She tugged him gently toward the corridor.
Look, we all used your data because Commander Antilles told us our exercise involved doing just that. It wasn't until we made our runs that he told each of us what had happened, what he had done to you. He ordered us to say nothing to you except to report our scores. None of us felt good about what happened, and we want to make it up to you.
He nodded and started walking with her.
So, how did you get the job of coming after me? You picked the Sabacc card with the lowest value?
Irisi smiled at him, her eyes dominating a delicately sculpted face with high cheekbones and a strong jawline.
I volunteered. Nawara Ven and Rysati Ina are trying to talk some sense into Bror, and I had to walk away.
You'd abandon a fellow Thyferan to a conversation with a Twi'lek lawyer?
Her laughter echoed faintly through the dim corridor. Strip illumination ran along the edges of the tunnel where the floor met the walls and gave them enough light to travel by, but most of the people in front of them were shadowed silhouettes.
Bror Jace is from a family that owns a significant portion of stock in Zaltine. His people are known for being rather haughty and obstreperous.
I hadn't noticed.
I would have thought you a keener observer than that.
She gave his arm a squeeze.
Besides, Bror has noticed you. He sees you as his chief rival for supremacy in this squadron.
He's forgetting the commander and Captain Selchu.
She shook her head.
No, he's not. Just ignoring them. As Commander Antilles said, those who have served with Rogue Squadron before are legends, and Bror doesn't think it's possible to defeat a legend. Become one, yes, but best one? Never.
Irisi, I appreciate your candor, but I'd hardly expect you to be speaking of a friend in such uncomplimentary terms.
What gave you the impression we were friends?
Perhaps the fact that you spend a lot of time with him?
Oh, that?
Irisi chuckled politely.
Better the Moff you know than the Emperor's new envoy. I could never be friends with anyone who grew up in the Zaltan corporate culture. My people are with Zucra, the true leader in Bacta production and refinement. My uncle was the person who discovered the contamination of the Ashran introduced into lot ZX1449F.
Really? The woman glanced sidelong at him, her face frozen for a millisecond. Then she smiled and playfully slapped his left shoulder.
You! I know Thyferan corporate politics is boring, but it's the lifeblood of my people. Though there are thousands of Raetics who actually grow Alarshi and refine Bacta, the 10,000 humans who run the corporations are really the people who make Bacta available to the galaxy. Since we're such a small community, and I'll admit, a fairly affluent one, We set great store in the accomplishments of our relatives.
Corin nodded as they stepped onto an escalator that took them down deeper into the heart of Folor.
Choosing one of you from each corporate family was meant to keep things even?
Were that possible, of course.
Arisi winked at him.
More of us would have been sent, I suspect. But strong involvement with the Alliance is a thing of fierce debate on Thyfera. Benign neutrality seems to be the course our leaders are choosing.
Playing both ends against the middle means big profits for the Bacta cartel.
But you felt strongly enough about the rebellion to volunteer to join it? There are times one must place higher ideals over personal safety.
At the bottom of the escalator, they stepped off and walked across a small chamber to a dark opening carved in smooth, melted stone. Beyond it lay a noisy stone gallery with next to no visible light, unless the bright colors of strobing neon tracery were to be considered adequate for lighting. Voices from dozens of alien throats croaked below or shrieked above the booming din of human conversation. The heavy, moist air stank of sweat, acrid, cloying smoke, and fermented nectars from hundreds of Alliance worlds, and not a few Imperial strongholds. Corin paused on the threshold of the makeshift tapcalf the rebels had named Downtime.
If I were still in Corsec, I'd be calling for backup before setting foot in a place like this.
Arisi, taking his hand in hers, led him into the room. As if she could see things he could not, she guided him between hologame-like tables and knots of pilots and techs. Back in the corner, a holoprojector had been set up. It appeared to be projecting a sporting event being broadcast down on Commoner, but the exoskeleton padding the players wore and the curiously spiked ball they tossed back and forth weren't from any game Corin recognized. Aside from a quartet of Ugnaughts sitting right at the edge of the projection ring and staring up at the towering figures, no one appeared to care about the game. The rest of Rogue Squadron had gathered in a corner of the tapcalf. Corin spotted Gavin first, both because of his size and his nervousness. The youth stared at all the different aliens as if he'd never seen them before. That surprised Corin, because he thought, with Mos Eisley being on Tatooine, Gavin would have had his fill of aliens.
Then again, I doubt the kid spent much time there. He's as green as the foam on Lominale.
Over on the right, Bror Jace and Nawara appeared to be deep in conversation. Sheel slipped past Corin and handed Gavin a mug full of a steaming liquid that smelled sweet. Lujane, seeing Corin, smiled at him and wrapped the heel of her mug on the table around which they stood.
Corin's here!
The Bothan's reaction to his arrival appeared to be relatively apathetic, but everyone else seemed to be pleased to see him. The Twi'lek pointed toward Corin with the tip of a head tail, and Bror Jace managed a tight smile. Stepping forward, the Thyferan pilot offered Corin his hand.
I want you to know. I would not have flown with your data had I known. I'd be the first to sign the letter of protest to General Somm.
Letter of protest?
Nawara looked a bit exasperated.
Some members of the squadron feel that a protest of Commander Antilles' treatment of you is in order.
Corin looked Nawara in the eyes.
You don't think so?
The Twi'lek slowly shook his head.
I don't think it will be effective, and I believe, quite honestly, that this incident is really fairly minor.
Corin smiled.
I'm glad to see someone hasn't lost a sense of perspective here.
Bror's blue eyes narrowed.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, my friends, we're part of a military unit, involved in an illegal insurgency against a government that controls the vast majority of planets in this galaxy. We're all volunteers here, and we've all come because we expect to win freedom and liberty for all sapient species by overthrowing the government. We're all willing to make the ultimate sacrifice if it comes to that. Yet,
We're going to protest how one of the most decorated and revered leaders conducts training exercises? I don't think so.
Gavin gave Corin a wide-eyed look of confusion.
But what he did to you wasn't right. It was nasty and cold and meant to hurt you.
I'll agree it was nasty and cold, but it wasn't meant to hurt me.
He looked around at the rest of the squadron.
Commander Antilles had a point to make with me, and he made it. And he made one with you. Your being here like this, your discomfort with what happened, and your desire to protest my treatment means I know you're going to be there when I need you to be. And you know I'm willing to do what I need to do to make sure our squadron can do its job. If that means I go in alone or with Oral or whatever to get information, I do it. The thing we all have to remember is this. There's nothing Commander Antilles can do to us that will be worse than what the Empire has already done on hundreds of worlds. They destroyed Alderaan. They destroyed the Jedi. And they'll destroy us if they can. Because of what he did today, Commander Antilles knows he can count on me. And I hope the rest of you do too.
Irisi raised Corin's left hand above his head.
I think Corin's correct. He might not have been the best pilot on the course today, but he's probably the one who learned the most.
Lujane stood and gave Corin a firm hug.
As the second worst pilot today, I say thanks, both for your skill and your wisdom here.
Corin blushed slightly, freed his left hand from Arisi's grip, and extricated himself from Lujane's hug.
Thanks to all of you. But just so you don't think I'm this cool-headed all the time, I have to admit that I had a discussion with Commander Antilles in which he pointed out most of these insights.
The wolfman growled in a low voice.
Yelling? Punches?
No. Just some clear and concise conversation.
Sheel bared his teeth, and Gavin laughed. Lujane fished into her flight suit's thigh pocket and produced a handful of oddly shaped credit coins. She held them out to the Twi'lek, who cupped them in both hands and smiled avariciously. He flicked at a couple with taloned fingers, then looked up and froze as if caught bloody-handed. Corin knit his fingers together and let them rest against his belt buckle.
And those credits are for...
winning the pool.
Nawara carefully slipped them into his pocket.
I said you'd be reasonable.
Rasati elbowed him.
You took reasonable because you got the best odds with that wager.
The Twi'lek looked offended.
I hold opinions. I don't bet them.
Corin laughed.
Who had will challenge Commander Antilles to an X-Wing death duel?
Irisi raised her hand.
It was an even odds bet, too.
Nawara won by betting what was in my brain, but you bet what was in my heart.
Corin pointed to the bar.
In honor of your insightfulness, I will buy you that which your heart desires.
She took his left hand again.
And if it doesn't have a price?
Then I'll buy you a drink, and we'll talk about how else to make you happy.
Bror Jace bowed from the waist in Arisi's direction.
To make her happy, you would have to make her family's corporation yet more profitable.
And to do that means I'd have to be boosting the use of Bacta, right?
Corin opened his hands and took in the whole of the squadron.
And since the Empire buys Bacta, and we'll be shooting at their pilots, I don't think that'll be hard to do at all.
10. The shuttle's pilot looked back over his left shoulder.
Agent Lore, you'll probably want to strap yourself in. We're coming out of hyperspace.
Kirtan began to fumble with the restraining harness, then brought his head up quickly, embarrassed that his lack of coordination betrayed his nervousness.
Thank you, Lieutenant, but I've traveled this way before.
Yes, sir, came the pilot's oily reply.
But I'd bet this is your first time to Imperial Center.
Kirtan wanted to snap some sharp reply that would sting the man, but a sense of utter and complete disaster washed over him. He had waited for 2 full weeks before reporting Gil Bastra's death to his superiors. In that time, he furiously analyzed and tried to expand upon any leads Bastra had offered during his interrogation. They all seemed to be dead ends, leading nowhere. But he knew, he just knew, they would put him on Corran Horn if he had enough time to figure out their greater significance. In his report, he had tried to stress the positive, but within hours of the report being sent on up the line, he had received his summons to Imperial Center, formerly known as Coruscant. He was ordered to make his way to the Imperial capital as quickly as possible. As luck would have it, luck he in no way saw as benign, passage had been arranged on a series of ships with a minimum of difficulty. This last ship, a shuttle on loan from the aggressor, effortlessly carried him to his doom. The wall of light visible through the viewport dissolved into a million points of light as the ship left hyperspace. Imperial Center, a clouded gray world ringed by Golan defense platforms, seemed even more forbidding than he had imagined. He had expected to see that the world that had become a city would be as dead and cold as the emperor who had ruled from it. Instead, with boiling clouds burned white by flashes of lightning, the planet's true nature lay cloaked and hidden, as did his future.
Imperial Center, this is Shuttle Objurium requesting clearance for entry on the Palace Vector.
Transmit clearance code, Shuttle Objurium.
Transmitting now.
The pilot turned back toward Kirtan.
This code better be good. We're well within the range of the 2 nearest Golan stations.
It is good, Kirtan blanched. I mean, it is the code I was given with my orders.
He started to go on to explain further, but saw the pilot and co-pilot exchange a quick wink and realized he was being teased.
Don't worry, Agent Lore. The days of the Empire blasting one of its own shuttles apart to kill an intelligence agent are long past. Can't spare the ships right now, which is what makes me a bit more secure.
Kirtan forced an edge into his voice.
And how do you know, Lieutenant, that I'm not here solely to monitor and report on your attitudes?
You're not the first man I've ferried to his death, Agent Lore.
Shuttle Objurium?
The comm squawked.
Clearance granted. Align course for Beacon 784432.
Understood, Control. Objurium out.
The pilot punched the beacon number into the navigation computer, then gave his co-pilot a more somber glance.
What?
Kirtan tried to stop himself from blurting the question out, and began to brace for some stinging jibe from the pilot, but he got none.
We're heading to Tower 78, level 443, Bay 2.
And?
Kirtan saw the pilot's Adam's apple bob up and down.
Sir, the only other time I've been given that vector is when I had the pleasure of shuttling Lord Vader to the Emperor. It was after the disaster at Yavin.
Kirtan felt a chill slowly pour into him and move up his spine, bone by bone.
Did Lord Vader fear retribution for his actions, as I do? Perhaps the Emperor had meant to kill him, but Vader redeemed his life by bringing news of the existence of another Jedi to his master.
Kirtan's fist hammered his right thigh.
Oof. If I had just a little more time, I could have delivered my quarry.
Ahead of the shuttle, Kirtan saw lightning flare from the clouds upward towards space. It hit and spread out, faintly illuminating a hexagonal area hanging above the clouds.
What is that?
Defense shield.
The pilot punched a couple of buttons on his command console. A miniature model of the world materialized between pilot and passenger. Then two spheres, made up of hexagonal elements, engulfed the world. The spheres moved in opposite directions around the world, constantly shifting, with the hexes in the upper layer covering more area than those below.
Imperial Center, for obvious reasons, has the most sophisticated system of defense shields in the Empire. A small portion of it will come down to let us in. Then that section will be reinforced behind us, while another one will open below.
Nothing can get in without clearance.
The pilot nodded.
Or out. More than one rebel agent has been caught trying to race back out while ships are coming in. It's a gamble, but not one that pays off very often.
The co-pilot pushed a glowing button on the console.
We're through the first shield.
Our next opening comes 2 degrees north, 4 east.
Course set, sir.
Not much longer until we're down, Agent Lore. The only thing that could go wrong now is a cloud discharging and trying to hit the upper shield through our opening.
Does that happen?
Sometimes.
Often?
The pilot shrugged.
The power for the upper shield comes through openings in the lower shield. This tends to ionize a lot of atoms, making lightning travel that much faster along those routes. However, it doesn't look like our hole served as an energy conduit very recently, so we should be safe.
Turbulence hit the shuttle as it pierced the layer of clouds. Kirtan tightened some of the belts restraining him, then clutched the back of the co-pilot's chair with white knuckles. He wanted to blame his growing feeling of nausea on the way the shuttle bounced down through the atmosphere, but he knew that was not its only cause.
The world beneath these clouds is the last thing I will see before I die.
The shuttle broke through the vapor shell around the planet, and the pilot smiled at him.
Welcome to Imperial Center, Agent Lore.
Despite his fear, Kirtan Lore looked out at the dark world below and felt overwhelmed by the panorama. Instantly recognizable, the Imperial Palace stood tall, like a volcano that had thrust itself up through the heart of the metropolis that dominated a whole continent of Coruscant. Towers festooned it as if spires on a crown. And thousands of lights sparkled like jewels set in an incandescent mosaic on its stone hide. Beneath it, dwarfed into insignificance, lay Senate Hill. Its tiny buildings, raised as monuments to the justice and glory of the old Republic, seemed frozen with fright that the palace would grow out and consume them. Spreading out from that central point, brilliant neon lights in all manner of colors pulsed, as if nerves carrying information to and from the palace itself. Kirtan followed one river of light as it shifted from red and green to gold and blue, from the heart of the world out to the horizon. As the ship swooped lower, he saw depths to the light streams, where buildings had accreted, sinking the streets into twisted, broken canyons. He knew the light could not reach all the way down, and his imagination had no difficulty in populating those black gashes with nightmare creatures and lethal danger.
But the lethal danger I face dwells above all this.
Kirtan sat back as the shuttle banked and the nose came up a bit. The pilot leveled the Abjurium off while the co-pilot flicked a switch above his head. A red square appeared on the shuttle's viewport and surrounded the top of one of the palace's towers. Lights blinked around an opening far too small to admit the shuttle, even with its wings folded up.
We can't be going there. Where will we land?
It looks small, Agent Lore, because we're still 3 kilometers away from it.
Kirtan's mouth hung open as his brain fought to put everything he was seeing in perspective. The streets below, which he had taken to be narrow tracks, had to be the size of major boulevards. And the towers, they were not slender, needle-like minarets, but massive buildings designed to house hundreds or thousands of people on each level. And the structures on the surface, they armored the planet with layer after layer of ferrocrete. Kirtan shuddered as he realized how deep the Warrens had to run on the planet. Yet he doubted anyone had set foot on the soil beneath Imperial City for centuries. It all struck him as impossible that a world could house that many people. But this was Coruscant. It was the heart of an empire that boasted millions of known worlds. If each one required only 1,000 people to deal with it and its problems, Coruscant would have to be home to billions of people. And to see to their needs, billions more would have to be in residence, working, building, cleaning. Suddenly, he went from wondering how Coruscant could house so many people to wondering if even billions of individuals were enough to oversee the empire. Oh, what's left of it? The Abjurium swept in closer to the tower. The opening appeared to be a black hole, waiting to suck him down and rend him atom from atom. Though logic argued against expending the money it cost to bring him to Coruscant just to kill him, he knew that death hovered close and would be seeking him out. He had failed, and the price the Empire demanded for failure was dear indeed. Kirtan ran a finger around his collar to loosen it. Arguing against his death, aside from the wasted expense of his travel, was a thought that proved utterly ludicrous to him. The only way he would stay alive was if he had something the person who had summoned him here found valuable. But he was just one person. The only thing he imagined he possessed that was not duplicated by 10 or 100 or 1,000 other people on Coruscant was his life. I have nothing else that is unique. The opening loomed close enough for Kirtan to see figures moving around in its shadows. The pilot punched a button on the command console. The shuttle's wings rose and locked up while the landing gear descended. The shuttle drifted forward, easing into the hangar, then slowly settled to the deck. It landed with only a slight bump, but Kirtan's nerves magnified until it felt as heavy as the blow of a vibroblade on his neck. Steeling himself for the worst, Kirtan slapped the buckle against his breastbone and slid free of the restraining harness.
Thank you, Lieutenant, for your efforts on my behalf.
The pilot watched him for a moment, then nodded.
Good luck, sir.
Kirtan pulled on a pair of black leather gloves and flexed his right hand.
Smooth flight back to the aggressor.
The intelligence agent stood slowly, letting his legs get used to the planet's gravity, then walked back from the cockpit and down the egress ramp. At the base of the ramp, 4 Imperial guards, resplendent in their scarlet uniforms, stood at attention. When he stepped into their midst, they turned as one and marched him toward the doorway at the far end of the hangar. The few people Kirtan saw in the hangar did not look at him directly. Even when he turned his head, seeking to catch one of them from the corner of his eye, they paid him no heed.
Have they seen so many people come this way and not return that it is no longer remarkable to them? Or do they think undue attention paid to me would find them being drawn along in my wake?
Being as tall as he was, he could almost see over the red dome of the guards' helmets. As nearly as he could determine, the 4 guards were identical in height and other physical dimensions, but their cloaks shrouded them sufficiently well that details that might have differentiated them one from another were lost. Because of that, they appeared to be identical to all the holograms he had seen of Imperial guards, with one minor exception. Their cloaks had been hemmed with a black ribbon. In the dim light, it had not been easy to pick out, and its presence almost made it appear as if the guards walked a few centimeters above the floor. The officially mandated year of mourning had ended over a year previously. Except, of course, on worlds where notification of the Emperor's death had arrived late, or worse yet, inspired open rebellion. Here on Coruscant, that was not a problem. So Kirtan took the ribbon as a sign of the guards' continued devotion to their slain master. They passed through the doorway and into a small corridor that seemed to extend on forever. Kirtan thought he noticed a slight arch to the floor and a tremble in the structure that suggested to him they had entered one of the bridges between the tower and the palace proper. The close passageway had no windows, and any decorations on the walls had been covered with meter after meter of black satin. Through the far end, and along another corridor, the guards brought him to a doorway, where two of their number stood. His escort stopped when the other two guards turned and pulled open the doors before him. He stepped through them into a large room, the far wall of which was constructed entirely out of glass. A tall, slender woman stood in silhouette before it, though the backlight from the planet's surface outlined her in red.
"You are Kirtan Moore."
It came not as a question, but a statement, full of import.
"Reporting as ordered."
He had tried to keep his voice as even and vital as hers had been, but he failed. A nervous squeak punctuated his sentence.
"I can explain my report."
"Agent Law, if I had wanted your report explained, I would have had your superiors go to great pains to extract that explanation from you."
She turned slowly toward him.
"Do you have any idea who I am?"
Kirtan's mouth had gone dry.
"No, ma'am."
"I am Isan Izard. I am Imperial Intelligence."
She opened her arms.
"I rule here now, and I'm determined to destroy this rebellion. I believe you can aid me in this task."
Kirtan swallowed hard.
"Me?
You."
Her hands returned to her sides.
"I hope my belief is not unfounded. If it is, I will have gone to great expense to bring you here for nothing. Accounts will have to be balanced, and I don't believe there is any way you can pay what you owe."
11. Wedge Antilles smiled when Admiral Ackbar nodded.
"I think you'll see, sir, that the squadron is coming along quite well."
The Mon Calamari looked up from the datapad on his desk.
"Your performance figures and exercise scores are commendable. Your people are better than some operational line units."
"Thank you, sir."
"Their level of discipline is not that of line units, however, Admiral."
Wedge looked over at General Psalm. The irritation in his voice matched the sour expression on the small man's face. Having come up through the ranks of Y-Wing pilots, Psalm had not been pleased when the rogues staged a training attack on a full wing of Y-Wing bombers. Though he had approved the exercise and had flown lead in one of the squadrons, he clearly had not expected things to go so badly for his trainees. The rogues had lost 4 of their own fighters, but had destroyed all but 6 of the Y-Wings. Psalm was one of the survivors, which Wedge felt was a good thing, and would have asked his pilots to leave Psalm alone if he had thought of it beforehand. Despite that, The nearly 8-to-1 kill ratio had been better than even Wedge had imagined possible, and had made Psalm furious.
I appreciate the general's assessment of my squadron, but these are elite pilots. I think making allowances for their high spirits promotes high morale.
Wedge lifted his chin.
My people have a lot to live up to.
Right now?
Psalm sniffed.
They're living down to the squadron name.
Begging your pardon, General. I think you're judging Rogue Squadron too harshly. And it's because we made your Guardian, Warden, and Champion squadrons look as if they were lame, sick, and dying.
The fighter pilot looked at Akbar.
Sir, there have been no incidents, aside from the exercise in which General Psalm was a willing participant, in which Rogue Squadron has done anything untoward.
The Mon Cal military leader set the data pad down.
I think General Psalm has legitimate concerns about modified computer code being downloaded into his Y-Wing's computers. I understand it painted your squadron crest on their primary monitor after they were shot down by your people.
Psalm's eyes blazed, and Wedge fought to keep a smile off his face. Gavin Darklighter had created the crest, and with Zry's help had linked a digitized image of it into the startup and communications packages in the squadron. The crest, which featured a 12-pointed red star with the Alliance crest in blue at the center, had an X-wing at each point of the star. Though the image was not sanctioned by the Alliance, Astrotex had started painting it on the squadron's X-wings, and M-Trey had requisitioned unit patches that featured the design. Wedge had been unable to determine if it was Corrin, Nawara, Sheel, Rosati, or some combination thereof who had talked the Verpine chief tech into adding the image to the target aggressor attack resolution software package, but he did know that Horn's R2 unit had done some of the code slicing. When the TAARS package informed the downed Y-Wing pilots of their status in the exercise, as Akbar noted, the Rogue crest showed up to annoy the bomber jocks.
I undertook an investigation into that situation, sir, and have restricted the unit's recreation time until I find out who did what in this whole thing.
Psalm scoffed at that explanation.
Ha! You have arranged for your squadron